Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Thank you, everyone, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum and Connect Your Intellect. I'm sorry, this is my first Inforum program. I've done a lot of Commonwealth Club programs, but Caroline, I finally made it that she's asked me to do an Inforum program. You can find Inforum online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter from our handle, @Amforum, and watch video of our past events on Fora TV. I'm Ruth Shapiro, principal of CUI Strategies and the Commonwealth Club's social entrepreneur in residence. Tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by John Mackey. John Mackey is the co-founder and co-CEO of the famous Whole Foods Market and the author of the new book, Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business. And for those of you who are sitting here and not in our radio audience, here it is. Mackey grew Whole Foods from a single store in Austin, Texas in 1978 to a $12 billion Fortune 300 company and one of the top U.S. supermarkets with over 340 stores worldwide. With 16 consecutive years on Fortune's list of the 100 best companies to work for, John has had a great deal of knowledge to share. So we're going to talk about his knowledge, Whole Foods, and his take on conscious capitalism. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, and let's give a round of applause for John Mackey. John, I imagine that the loudness of that applause will only be surpassed by at the end of this discussion.
Let's hope so.
Okay. I want to just get some context for this, and I'd like you to talk about starting off with that one store in Texas. I knew that that was the case, but I spent a lot of time in Palo Alto, and the people in Palo Alto think that that store was actually the original store, and that philosophically they think that that is right and true. So tell us about starting Whole Foods in Austin, Texas, and how and the growth of the company.
That's a big story, so...
Okay.
But I mean,
I don't want quite the Twitter version, but it's something a little.
How many
bit
words
more
have I got here? We had originally had a store called Safer Way, and it was a take on Safeway. Mm-hmm. Started that in 1978. We started with $45,000 in capital, which we got from friends and family. We did manage to lose half of that in our very first year. We lost $23,000 in our first year. My girlfriend and I were living in the house where the store was, so we really literally lived above the store. We weren't supposed to be there. It wasn't zoned for anybody to live there, but we were poor. We were only getting $200 a month. And even back in 1978, that will not go that far. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have I like to tell the story that we didn't have a place to, we didn't have no shower or bath, so we actually climbed in the Hopart dishwasher and drew ourselves down, and we did make a little bit of money the second year, and I started to figure out business. I had no business background. I never took any business classes in school. I have a very interesting resume. You know, I have dishwasher, busboy, CEO, Whole Foods Market. So we figured a little bit out. We made $5,000 the second year, and we decided we knew what we were doing, but we needed a bigger store. So we found a location that went from 3,000 to 10,000 square feet. We opened the first natural food supermarket in Texas and merged with another store that we were competing with and opened that very first store. And so we had to change the name because the store we were merging with, of course, didn't want to share. They didn't want to call it Safer Way. So we came up with Whole Foods Market. It went along great. It was an incredibly successful store from the first moment we opened it. And then Austin had its worst flood that it had in over 100 years Our store was 8 feet of water, Memorial Day, 1981. Hmm. And it was a life-changing event because I referenced it in the book in the introduction. Because when we showed up to clean up the store the day after that flood, there was a total wreck. But we had dozens of customers that had come in to shop, and they were helping us clean up the store. And then we had neighbors come in to help us. And I got my stakeholder philosophy because all these different stakeholders pitched in to save Whole Foods Market. Our customers helped us clean up the store. Our team members, they worked for free while we were trying to get the store rebuilt. Our suppliers fronted us new inventory on credit. Our investors put new capital in. The bank loaned us new money. I thought we were bankrupt and dead, and they didn't let us die. So I really got the stakeholder philosophy at that time, that we were really about the stakeholders, and we wanted to pay them all back. We wanted to create value for all of them. And then from there, that really spurred us to do a second store. It's like you can't have all of your eggs in one grocery basket that's subject to having 8 feet of water on top of it. So we did a second store. I've always paid a lot of attention to flood zones ever since then. We've not gone back into a flood zone area. Second store was also successful. And then we jumped out of Austin and went to Houston, had a third store there. And so Palo Alto comes along in 1989 when it was our first store out of Texas. And I remember I came and lived in Palo Alto for about a couple of weeks. And I decided, this was back in 1988, 89 when I visited, that whoever invented the word yuppie probably came from Palo Alto. Because I remember going back and telling one of my co-founders, Craig Willard, I said, these people are more Whole Foods Market than we are.
Right.
I thought we would do very well there, and we did.
Right.
The store was very successful there.
Right.
And then when we went to the Berkeley and then Mill Valley, where Walter Robb joined the company, the co-CEO of the company, and then we started doing, we raised venture capital money, then we went public in 1992, we did an initial public offering. That made a huge difference, because then we raised $28 million of capital. For the first time, I could pay bills on time. And it's the hardest thing when you're a small business, is you just never have enough money, you're growing, and your working capital is stretched. And we also now had a currency that we could use to purchase other companies. So we acquired Bread and Circus in Boston and Mrs. Gooch's in L.A. and mm-hmm. Fresh Fields in Washington, D.C. And that formed these beachheads or these platforms that we could use, we could grow from. And then we just gradually grew in different areas of the country. Skipping way ahead because I don't think you want to hear the whole story. And voila, here we are today.
Now, I lived in London when you opened your store there.
So you want me to talk about that a little bit?
No. But how many international stores do you have now?
Well, we're in Canada. We've been very successful in Canada, and we're in Toronto and Vancouver, but we've signed a store in Ottawa, and we're looking in other markets there.
Well,
so we do very well in Canada. We've identified that Canada is probably a $1 billion market for us, and at least 30 stores. Mm-hmm. And the UK has been tougher for us, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. You have to start your supply chain over from scratch.
Right.
It's like every supplier you have in the United States, they're no good over there. You know, they don't conform, and it's hard to bring food over. So we've had to build it from scratch. We have little stores, and we have a giant flagship store in London called the Kensington store, which is finally, it's a beautiful store, but it took a while for that store to start producing some positive cash flow for us, which it's doing now. And we've just expanded to, a year and a half ago, we went to Glasgow. We just opened a store in Cheltenham. We've got two other stores in development in the London area, plus some little stores from an acquired company. And I don't know where else we'll go internationally. I think we will expand internationally. I just don't know when or where. It's not like it's a high priority. It's not like Starbucks. You're selling the same coffee pretty much wherever you go. Mm-hmm. You've got to build your supply chain up from scratch. And Whole Foods deals with about 100,000 suppliers across our company. We have a lot of suppliers. And it takes a while to build those relationships. And we're building some good supplier relationships in the UK now, but frankly, It's been a long haul, and I know we're not there yet in terms of supply chain. And
that would be true recreating in any country.
Exactly.
Well, I have to tell you that I bring, when I have guests come from other countries without Whole Foods, you know, you bring them to Muir Woods, you bring them to Fisherman's Wharf, I also bring them to a Whole Foods.
Well, thank you.
And they say, when are you coming to Malaysia or China? So now we can see. But let's get back to the book and your life. The term safer way that you started with obviously has a normative aspect to it.
No, it's just a joke.
Really?
Sure.
So you weren't trying to bring organic or local food that were different than Safeway at that time?
We thought it was funny.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I mean, one of the things to understand, I mean, I self-identify as an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs tend to be fairly creative people.
Right.
And they have a lot of fun. And sometimes it befuddles me. I do a lot of things that I'm just having a good time doing it. I don't take it that seriously. But other people tell me CEOs aren't supposed to act that way. And I oftentimes think these little playful things I do end up taking on this enormous import. And I find that actually kind of odd.
Well, it's just that I immediately thought, because, you know, Whole Foods has been really involved in the locavore mentality, sure, in eating well and eating fresh. So that's why, I mean, certainly when you open your store, bringing those concepts and those realities to the marketplace was part of your motivation and your business plan.
Absolutely.
Right.
Definitely part of our purpose for existing. But even having a higher purpose doesn't mean you're not playful.
No, that's true. Okay, so that's fair. So the higher purpose of Whole Foods was part of your business plan and your business vision from the beginning, from that first Austin tour.
Yes, but purpose evolves over time. It just like the consciousness evolves over time, purpose evolves over time. Whole Foods' original purpose was very simple. Let's sell healthy food to people, let's earn a living, and let's have some fun doing it. That was really the original purpose of Whole Foods. And our purpose, though, my next book will outline how the purpose has evolved over time. But now we have these much, you know, more heroic purposes because Whole Foods has scaled up, it has so much bigger impact. So now we identify some of our higher purposes as we want to help heal America. I mean, America's sick. I'm serious. We're 69% overweight, 36% obese. 80% of the money we spend on health care in America goes to basically lifestyle diseases, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, autoimmune diseases, largely relate back to diet and lifestyle. And they're not going to be cured. We're not going to have a vaccination for cancer. Heart disease isn't going to be reversed with a drug. These are things that we're doing to ourselves mostly. And not always. There are other factors involved. It can be genetic. But they correlate very highly with diet and lifestyle. So one of our higher purposes is to help educate people how to eat a healthy diet, how to avoid these diseases, how to be vital and thin and live to be 90, live to be 100 with a clear mind, and a vital, healthy body. I think that's part of Whole Foods' higher purpose. We also want to change the agricultural system to create a sustainable agricultural system, sustainable seafood, high animal welfare standards, an agricultural system with more environmental integrity, and yet also highly productive and efficient. Now we've gotten our whole planet foundation, we realize we have a higher purpose to help help end poverty on the planet Earth. We've affected over a million people's lives in the developing world and helped in poverty. And finally, fourth higher purpose, I'm doing it tonight. We're trying to spread the vision of conscious capitalism, that business can be more conscious and can help transform the world.
Which gets me, I mean, obviously what you just said leads to a whole bunch of questions, but let's back up and say, and let me ask you, why'd you write this book?
Partly because I thought it'd be fun.
I just wrote a book, I have to say.
Was it
fun? I didn't think.
No. Well, I said I thought it would be fun. Some of it was fun. Some of it was a grind and hard. But I think we wrote the book because we think the message is important. We basically think the narrative about business has been captured by the enemies and critics of business. It's perceived, business people are perceived as basically selfish and greedy and exploitative. They're not seen as good. As an example, over 90% of the murders that you see on television are committed by business people. Think about it. Look at all the television shows, the movies. It's usually some greedy bastard business person who all he cares about is money. And after he rips off his employees and dumps his waste products in the rivers, and then he goes out and shoots people. I mean, the business has a very, very bad reputation. So we think business is the greatest creator of value in the world. So we wrote this book partly to try to change the narrative about business. As I always like to say, business is fundamentally good, but we can make it a lot better. And this book is about how to make business a lot better. And that's why we wrote it.
And obviously by going out, you are hoping to talk to as many people who are involved in business as you possibly can to share these insights.
I find business people really like these ideas, and they gravitate to it. People who are not in business are kind of hostile to the whole idea that business could be good and do good. I find that interesting.
So let's talk about conscious capitalism. You mentioned that there are higher purpose is one of the core tenets, and, mm-hmm. and you went through those, and we're going to go through those in terms of fleshing them out a little bit. There are three others, and I'd like to just go through and have you explain what they are.
Well, we do think there are four basic tenets. One is higher purpose, mm-hmm. Besides just making money. Secondly, that the business should exist to create value for all of the major stakeholders and not just the investors. So that we identify the major stakeholders as customers, employees, suppliers, investors, communities, and the environment. They're all interdependent. They're all connected together. The conscious business creates business strategies that create value for all of them. So it's a bigger conception of business's role. Third, we need a different type of leader in the conscious business. You can't have a conscious business if you don't have conscious leadership. And that holds back businesses tremendously. I know I held Whole Foods back. Possibly I still am, but I held it back for years. And it wasn't until I got more awake myself that the company could move forward. So we need servant leaders. We need leaders who are really dedicated to the mission of the business, who aren't in it just to get as many stock options and get as big a bonus as possible. And a lot of businesses still do that, particularly in corporate America. So we need a different kind of leader. We also need a different kind of culture. The fourth component is a more empowered, humanistic culture. Organizations need to create cultures where human beings flourish, where they can self-actualize themselves and reach their highest potential. So purpose, stakeholders, leadership, culture, they all fit together.
When you did go public, did you get pushback? I mean, this notion of conscious capitalism had evolved, but you were going into the market and people were buying your stock because they thought they would make money.
Right.
So, was there pushback on these ideas when you went public? Did your bankers say, please don't talk about these ideas when you did your road shows?
I'll make a couple of comments on it. First of all, the only time the investors ever push back is if the stock goes down. I always like to joke.
That makes sense.
When the stock goes up, people think they're brilliant investors. And when the stock goes down, they think the CEO is the village idiot. And so whenever we'd see the stock fall off, people would start to criticize, particularly in the early days. They'd say, oh, my God, this would be such a great company if this guy, if they just weren't doing these crazy philosophy. And of course, the stock would go back up again, and we were golden again. But my second comment is that, because this is a question I get all the time, you know, is it must be really hard. How can you be a public company and be a conscious business? Because the Wall Street and all the short-term thinking that the investors have. But I will tell you that in my experience, in a lot of ways, the investor stakeholder is the easiest one to deal with. If you think about all the stakeholders want more. They do. Customers want lower prices. They think you're too expensive. They want higher quality. They want better service. Team members, they want higher pay, better benefits, better working conditions. They want to get promoted. Suppliers want you to sell all their products on the shelves, not just a few. And they want to give fewer discounts. Communities, they want more donations if they're nonprofits. Governments want higher taxes. And so everybody wants more. The investors are the easiest ones. They just want the stock price to go up. If you do that, they'll pretty much leave you alone. So in my own experience, the customers are actually the most difficult stakeholders because you're always doing something wrong, and there's a lot of customers. And so they'll give you contradictory advice. One will tell you that the very thing they dislike about you, somebody else will say, don't ever change that. So the customers I found to be the most difficult, team members second. In a lot of ways, the investors, as long as you can make money for them, they don't really care. They're agnostics. You could have any philosophy in the world. As long as the stock goes up, they're happy. They're geniuses.
Okay. Well, that's good. Let's go back to some of the higher purpose issues you were talking about. eBay prides itself on creating so many businesses as on the eBay platform.
Right.
I would imagine that there's been a lot of agribusinesses created on the platform that Whole Foods has provided. Is that
true.
The case?
Yes. Of course, we wouldn't quite use the terminology agribusiness, but there have been lots of small mom-and-pop businesses that started from nothing and then have grown great businesses, and Whole Foods has been instrumental in that growth.
Is agribusiness a bad word?
Yeah. Would you want to be called agribusiness?
If I was one, maybe.
But would you want to be? I mean, I don't think it's usually that term slightly, I think, would be pejorative.
Really?
I've been sensitized in the last week about language.
Okay. Well, the other things I'm staying away from. Agribusiness is a new one. But, okay. So when you go out and work with mom and pop farmers, and does Whole Foods help them to succeed? How do you work with them? How do you identify them, and how do you bring them up?
Well, we do a number of things. Uh-huh. For example, I was just talking to the Northern California forager today. We have foragers in a lot of our regions, who basically go out and forage for new supply. They'll go to farmers markets, for example, and they'll talk to the farmers and see if they would like to sell larger quantities to retail stores. We don't even have to have it in all of our stores. It could just be in one store to start out.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a local loan program. So our company's given out, I don't know how many total local loans are, but I think it's getting close to $10 million in local loans that we've given out. And in fact, I met three local loan recipients today on this tour who were so grateful to Whole Foods because we loan up to $500,000. We can get a local loan from Whole Foods Market, which is low interest and long term. And it's made a huge difference. It's really helped a lot of these small business entrepreneurs really get going, and so we're very proud of that. So yes, we seek out unique new supply, and we do what we can to help them to succeed and flourish. It's part of conscious business because the supplier stakeholder is very important. It's one of the stakeholders. We think it's very important to help them to succeed and help them to flourish.
So that kind of, and this is probably another bad word, I mean, in some ways, you're providing management consulting advice to them. I mean, you're right, helping them to grow and create the systems that they need in order to be in one store or more stores rather
We're trying to be good partners with them.
Uh-huh.
We're working together to create, think about it, you partner up with your suppliers to create value for the customers.
But then that adds to your transaction costs.
I suppose it adds something, but there's something that comes back. We get unique new supply that our competitors may not have for a while. They'll pick it up eventually, but we may have it for a while. They haven't been discovered by our competitors, and so that helps us be unique and differentiated in the marketplace. We see that as win-win.
But I guess I'm getting at, John, that, you know, one of the critiques of Whole Foods is that it's quite pricey. And aside from the 365...
I haven't heard that before. Where did that come from?
Aside from the 365 line, which is less pricey...
I think that's quite good value, actually. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It is good value, but okay. It's less pricey than the others.
Okay.
Okay. One of the reasons for the higher costs may be these additional transaction costs from working with, not working with Cargill, for example. I don't know. Maybe you do work with Cargill, but the huge kind of those would be agribusinesses.
I will concede the point that Cargill would qualify as agribusiness. But most of our suppliers do not want to be compared to Cargill.
Right.
Or Monsanto, for example. That's
a
word you don't want. You don't want to be compared to Monsanto, trust me.
Right, but you tend to work with smaller providers, and so therefore I'm just wondering, that does increase your costs and therefore increase.
Because Whole Foods Market's first core value is we want to sell the highest quality natural and organic foods available. So we're a quality operator. That's really what we're all about. We're not in there trying to sell the least expensive food possible. Just like there's a continuum in almost every category, it's a continuum of quality in clothing, a continuum of quality in automobiles, a continuum of quality in smartphones. In every aspect of our lives, we have a continuum of quality. And they're not all the same. We're not trying to be the least expensive. We're trying to be the very best. Mm-hmm. And we find that to be the very best means that it's going to be a little bit more expensive. But yet, obviously, a lot of people prefer to get the highest quality, and they're willing to pay a little bit more to get it.
Right.
Our business model works. Although it tends to bother some people that that we're not the least expensive grocery in town. But we're not. But we've worked really hard the last few years on our value. We're really proud that we've got a large selection of value, high quality, but still very value-priced foods available. Mm-hmm. Something we didn't have to the same degree a few years ago.
That's true. Let me ask you, though, you mentioned poverty alleviation as one of the themes mm-hmm. in your higher purpose. How does Whole Foods impact on poverty alleviation? What's the connection there? How can you do that?
Are you talking about, you want me to talk about the Whole Planet Foundation? You're talking about the what we're doing there with our microcredit loans in the developing world?
Yes.
Okay.
I want to know what you're doing to alleviate poverty in the world.
Okay.
We
started about 8 years ago a foundation we call the Whole Planet Foundation. Uh-huh. I read Muhammad Yunus's book, Banker to the Poor. And I don't know if you've read that book. That's an amazing book. And I read that and I thought, this is incredible. And then somehow or other I got to meet Muhammad Yunus. And I was so impressed with him that, I want to work with this guy. And so we created the Whole Planet Foundation, which does microcredit loans. Our theory is Whole Foods Market trades in like 79 countries right now around the world. And we think that... we could potentially can do projects in all 79 countries, and we're expanding the number of countries that we do business in all the time. So it's kind of like when we think about our social responsibility. What's our responsibility to communities? Mm-hmm. And we have a responsibility where we have stores. We have responsibility in San Francisco and Palo Alto and Mill Valley and Berkeley, wherever we have stores. And we feel like we have responsibilities across the United States because we're trading all over the United States. But then, do we have a responsibility to these communities in the developing world where we're sourcing a lot of products? We thought about it, and we said, you know what? I think we do. And how can we best impact in a positive way these communities we're trading in? We said, why don't we start microcredit? Why don't we make microcredit loans in these developing countries? So we started doing that, and now we're in 55 countries. We've done microcredit loans in 55 countries. We've now made about 300,000 loans therefore impacting about 1.2 million people. And they're 93% women. And the most staggering statistic at all, there's no collateral on these loans, and there's no contract. And yet there's a 98% repayment. It's astounding, isn't it? I mean, that's a lot better repayment than we got in our local loan program. And we've got collateral and contracts there.
Do you use the Grameen methodology?
We do. Yeah. And we also set up a volunteer program with our team members. Our team, we've got our own little kind of Peace Corps where Whole Foods Market team members can volunteer for a couple of weeks. And the young millennials go down there and their lives are changed.
Right.
It's phenomenal. So that's one thing we're doing for poverty, to poverty alleviation. Another thing that we're in the process of developing, mostly due to the brilliant efforts of my co-CEO, Walter Robb, who lives here in the Bay Area, we're starting a new foundation called the Whole Cities Foundation, because we really want to go into these food deserts where there's a lack of access to healthy, nutritious food. And we're developing a new business model for it. We're going to have out of the way locations. We're going to pay low rent. We're not going to make fancy stores. They're going to be simple, smaller stores, and we're going to cut our labor back, so we'll be less service, but it's going to be a lot less expensive. It's going to be available in these food desert areas. So we think that's going to help alleviate poverty, because it's going to help people that doesn't have access to healthy foods to be able to afford natural and organic foods for much lower prices. So we're excited about that.
That's a great idea. And
you can do it too, because we're not going to trademark it. You feel free to do that as well.
Well, I just wrote a book on social entrepreneurship where Muhammad Yunus is one of my contributors, so I do feel like I'm helping.
Yeah, yeah. He's one of my personal heroes.
But I think that's good, because food deserts, actually, that's a number of people are asking questions about, you know, it's one thing to be in Palo Alto and Mill Valley, but, you know, what are you doing in Oakland? And so...
Got a store in Oakland, too.
Right. Well, Oakland's mixed, but... I meant that more metaphorically, I suppose. Those are all good. Thank you for telling us about that. Have you done press about these inexpensive stores in urban areas?
We've got a store opening in Detroit. Uh-huh. That we worked with the mayor, Dave Bing, on there. And if you follow what's happening in Detroit, that whole city's been hollowing out, and we're going back into the inner city, and we've got a lot of press about that, and now Walter is working with various... Once the Detroit thing became public, we got contacted by virtually half the mayors in the United States. We got Cory Booker in Newark and Rahm Emanuel in Chicago and Jerry Brown, when he used to be the mayor of Oakland before he became the governor of California. And Walter's talked to probably a dozen other ones. And so New Orleans, and we're looking in lots of different areas. Well, no doubt we'll pick locations that are where we can easily support the stores from our regional infrastructure. And we should be making some announcements. Walter's here. So, Walter, what, in the next 6 months, you think we'll have some announcements about that? Yeah.
And what is it going to be called, Whole Foods?
Well, if the store is set up as a nonprofit, which many of these will be, so that if it makes any money, we'll recycle that money back into supporting the communities. We'll call it Whole Cities. Uh-huh. To differentiate it from Whole Foods.
Uh-huh. Great. So you've gotten a lot of attention about your views on healthcare.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I won't quote you on any of this, but what are...
If you did, you'd be the only one quoting me accurately.
Well, I'm really not going to quote you, because I don't know exactly what you said.
Neither does anybody else.
But you do have strong feelings about the Affordable Health Care Act that was enacted in the last Congress, otherwise known as Obamacare. I'd like you to just tell us what your views are on that and how your position as the founder and CEO of Whole Foods has helped bring about your views on that.
I will talk a little bit about it, but I'm not going to spend much time on it, because... when I've been traveling around trying to promote my book, all anybody wants to talk about is health care. And conscious capitalism is totally not political at all. So I feel like people are beginning to associate things I might have said about healthcare with conscious capitalism when they're totally not related. So the main thing is I am passionate about capitalism. When you read the first chapter of the book, as we document how capitalism has changed and improved our world, it has lifted humanity out of poverty. Hundreds of millions of people are leaving poverty every decade, primarily due to countries like China and India now turning towards more free market philosophies and economics. Some of the statistics are like 85% of the people, 200 years ago, 85% of the people alive lived on less than $1 a day. Mm-hmm. Today it's 16%. 200 years ago, over 90% of the people alive were illiterate. The average lifespan was under 30. Today it's 68. Across the world, 78 in the United States and 80 in Japan. We've seen great progress, and I think it's primarily due to capitalism. So I'm a great enthusiast for capitalism. I would like to see our healthcare system. It hasn't really been free enterprise capitalism for over 50 years, and we've moved to more and more regulated system, the continued loss of competitive. Nobody knows what anything costs in our healthcare system. There is no real price competition. It's crony capitalism at best. It's a cartelized system. And now it's going towards a more and more government-controlled system. I believe in free enterprise capitalism. I believe that's what our healthcare system should be based on. Yes, with a safety net, of course. We don't want to throw anybody under the bus. We don't want to throw cancer patients out on the street. We need to take care of everybody, but we can do that with a vital, vibrant, free enterprise capitalistic system. I think that would create greater innovations, and it would help. It would drive costs down, as it does in every other area. Computers have gotten cheaper. iPhones get cheaper. Believe it or not, healthcare could get cheaper if we really let the free market and let free enterprise work. We're not doing that. We haven't done it in a long time. As a result, we've gotten a more and more bureaucratized, government-controlled system, which is not delivering the results that we want from it. So that's what I'm in favor of. And I get frustrated. Whole Foods, for example, has a great healthcare system for our team members. It works really well. Our team members really like it. And it's going to be radically changed. So I'm not happy about that. I don't want to see that system destroyed because the government tells us it's no longer acceptable and we have to do this and this and this. So that's why I've spoken up. And yet, of course, that's not what conscious capitalism is about, and this couldn't be put together. I've used some language about it that I regret. I've apologized 15 times last week in New York on national television. I will once again apologize. I was a bad choice of words, it's got a lot of bad associations with it. I regret saying it. I apologize to this audience as well.
But let's talk about the nexus between healthcare and Whole Foods, and that would be your employees. Mm-hmm. You have a great healthcare system now. What are the changes that you envision are going to have to take place next year? Well, this year now.
Well, we've customized our healthcare plan that makes it very affordable. Let me tell you how it works.
Okay.
If you work 30 hours or more at Whole Foods Market, you're automatically covered into our healthcare plan. You're just automatically in it. And it's a high deductible plan, so it's got about a $3,000 deductible. But we supplement that for our team members by paying up to $1,800 into what we call a personal wellness account. This is money that if you don't spend, you can use that for the deductible, or you can use it for things that aren't covered, like dental or vision care or chiropractic or acupuncture, things that might not be a high deductible type of care. And so that's made this plan very affordable, and it's enabled us to cover everybody. 75% of our team members work over 30 hours. That's very, very rare in retail. Mostly it's part-time people that work in retail, and that's so they don't have to provide health care coverage.
And that's increasing now, I think.
Well, one of the concerns that I have is that as the corporations, the system that we've had that's changing is that the states regulated health care. Every state set its own regulations. But corporations like Whole Foods that were self-insured avoided all of those state regulations because we were covered under a different act, the ERISA Act. And we could customize our health care plan for our own team members. And every company could do it a little bit differently. And Whole Foods Market did it deliberately so that we made this high deductible plan that didn't cover certain things like dental or... but if you got an automobile accident or a disaster occurred to you, you were going to be covered and taken care of. The corporations or the companies or the individuals that were in state-regulated things had much higher health insurance costs than we had to pay because all of these lobbyists would get into the states and they would say, you've got to cover this. You've got to cover in vitro fertilization. For example, in Massachusetts, you've got to cover in vitro fertilization. That raises the cost of health insurance plan $750. Now, most people don't want in vitro fertilization. They shouldn't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. But if the government says you must cover that or your plan will not be covered, you have no choice. Whole Foods Market does not cover in vitro fertilization. That's an elective action for people that want to bear children. It's certainly worthwhile. I just don't think it belongs in health insurance. So as lobbyists line up and they're going to push this to be covered and this to be covered and this to be covered, it's going to drive up the cost of health insurance. That is the reality of what's going to happen over time. And as they tell us we have to cover these things, we'll have to comply, we will cover it, and that's going to raise the cost. That's either going to mean there's less money we have to pay wages to people or other benefits, or Whole Foods will reluctantly start to do what every other business is going to end up doing too, which is we're going to say, yeah, you know, you got to work for our company for a year before you can be full-time. So we'll end up having a greater percentage of part-time people right. in order to keep our costs competitive to everybody else we're having to compete against. So I don't think that's in the best interest of our team members. I don't think that's in the best interest of our society. So I've spoken up about health care. I can tell you it's a thankless task. Got all these people hate my guts. I regret doing it. Just don't really want to talk about health care anymore because I'm tired of being hated by everybody.
Okay, well, I'm not going to ask a follow-up question then.
Thank you.
But I do want to ask you about sustainability before we get to the audience. And let me just say, we are having two microphones here, so if we're going to get to your questions in a few minutes, so if you have a one-sentence question, please go ahead and feel free to line up. But sustainability, huge issue.
Yeah.
You have all kinds of great food in your stores. Sustainability clearly has an impact on your business. And you do have strong views about climate change as well. Is it a company's responsibility to try to bring about sustainability?
I think it's, if you're a conscious business, I think it is. I think, but sustainability is kind of this, it's kind of a difficult word because...
Is it too much of a buzzword? I guess?
Well, everybody defines it a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's your definition?
Well, I think sustainability in terms of food would be foods that are environmentally sustainable, meaning that, let's take it depending on the category. If it's seafood, then a sustainable seafood would be fish that's not being fished greater than its ability to renew itself. And if it's being fished greater than its ability to renew itself, you're gradually destroying the sustainability of that fish. It will not be able to last for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take cod, for example. Cod used to be the most abundant fish in the New England fisheries. Whenever Columbus came over here, it was just like this huge booming business. Well, we've reduced cod stocks by 95%. Cod's not a sustainable fish any longer. It used to be the most abundant fish on the East Coast, and now it's not even a sustainable one because we overfished it. So we've worked with Monterey Bay Aquarium and Blue Ocean Institute, and we've identified the red unsustainable fish, and we phased all of those out of our... We don't sell those any longer. And we also work with the Marine Stewardship Council to get certain fisheries certified as sustainable so that we can be working with them as well. So that would mean what it would mean for seafood. It could mean a different thing for in different areas, such as agriculture or potentially meat production. Mm-hmm. You could make the very well case that livestock production, the way we're doing it now with these factory farms, is not sustainable in the long term. The waste products that we're throwing off, the amount of rainforest that we're plowing under to plant grains to feed the cattle is probably not sustainable practice. So I think you have to take that word and you have to almost define it for each category of food that you want to apply it to.
And I imagine that within your company that you have created systems to do that, to think about the sustainability implications on everything that you buy and source and sell.
We have. One of the big initiatives Whole Foods are working on now, I'm going to give you a hint about the future, is we think organic's great, but it doesn't measure sustainability to the degree it needs to be measured.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working now internally and with some outside agencies. We want to start doing a sustainable rating of all the produce that we sell. And that things like, how's the water utilized? What kind of waste, agricultural runoff are we getting from any kind of fertilization? Is it infecting the groundwater? Is it contaminating groundwater? What type of pesticides are being used if it's not organic? Are these the Dirty Dozen pesticides? If so, shouldn't we be transparent about that? Shouldn't we have disclosure about that? So we're working to develop a system so we can begin to rate our produce based on its sustainability. I think it'll go beyond organic. It'll include organic, but go beyond it. So this is something very important to our company's culture and our sense of what our higher purpose is.
That's very exciting. I just arrived back from China, and of course they had record air pollution in Beijing last week. But also there was a big article about how pig excrement is essentially the number one source of pollution in China because there's so many.
It's a huge source of pollution in the United States. I mean, there are some pig factory farms that produce more waste products than the entire city of Los Angeles does. It's just one factory farm. And disposing of those waste products is an immense environmental problem.
So do you feel like Whole Foods has reached the size where can you see the impact that you have on these? I mean, this is policy that you're talking about. And you are taking positions on policy with something like food rating.
You know, one of the kind of mythologies Whole Foods has to deal with and conscious businesses have to deal with is that small business, Americans are kind of romantic about small businesses. But at some point, it becomes a big business. And then they become scared of it. It's evil. It's corrupt. It's dangerous. And I think that's possible. But scale in itself is neither good nor bad. It depends upon what the business is doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Whole Foods is doing far more good in the world today as a large business than ever was doing when it was a small business. Because our ability to impact things is huge. We've had a big impact. I mean, organic, would it be where it is today if Whole Foods Market hadn't come along? I mean, it would still exist, but it wouldn't have caught on this way in the supermarket industry. That's all been Whole Foods has mostly driven that. I think now the seafood sustainability stuff, we were the first ones to work with Marine Stewardship Council. We're the ones that Walmart ended up looking at and copying. So I do think we're having a bigger impact. We're proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think as we continue to grow, our ability to impact the world for good will be... will also be extended and accelerated.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's go to questions, and we'll start right over here.
Hi, my name's Tim. NPR recently had a really interesting article that was talking about Bolivian farmers and how with the popularization of quinoa as a grain, it's really benefited a lot of these local farmers. Mm. But on the flip side, it also has raised the price of quinoa for locals. And as my mom is Bolivian, how do you balance this kind of interesting paradox where you're helping local farmers be able to develop further, but at the same time you're raising the costs of a very popular grain in a country like Bolivia?
I mean, if that happens, that's a market signal that farmers should plant more quinoa.
Mm.
And that's what will happen. It'll just, there's lag periods. Sometimes things get more expensive entrepreneur business people look in and say, I can make a lot of money planting quinoa. And so they plant it, and then 5 years later, it's like there's too much quinoa, and prices collapse. And they'll be telling the other thing, well, this has been good for the local people, but it's been terrible for exports. So it's just the way business evolves. Supply and demand are not ever perfectly. They tend to, one gets out of whack for a while and then it readjusts. The pendulum swings further in the opposite direction. I can tell you that organic is still expensive, but it's a lot less expensive than it was 10 years ago. It's a lot more available, and that's due to additional additional production coming online. Mm-hmm. So, but somebody will say, gee, organic farmers don't make as much money anymore because prices are lower. There's always going to be consequences to things that happen, and some of them are good and some of them are less good, depending on what side you're looking at it from, your perspective.
Okay, let's switch sides. Yes, sir.
My name's Scott.
Oh. I recommend, oh no, he's in that. So I was going to say, you look like you're the only person there, and there's a bigger line over there, so I'm doing some doing some line shifting.
All right, well, let me do my job, John, and you do yours.
Okay, you're not doing your job that well, so get some people over there.
My God. Okay. The first question was okay. Let's go to the second.
Hi, I'm Scott. You mentioned your commitment to poverty alleviation and through microcredit and affecting 1.2 million people. Considering that there's almost a billion people in the world that are hungry because of lack of access to cheap food or food in general, considering like the recent studies that have been done about GM food and like the fact that it increases yield and it has shown not really any detrimental health effects, how do you reconcile your commitment to providing food and or providing access to food to poor people?
So your question is, what's his position on genetically modified food?
Why he might be opposed if it could possibly reduce poverty, considering the studies that have been done on it recently.
All right, thank you.
You know, there's actually two topics I will not talk about tonight under any circumstances. I will not talk about abortion, and I will not talk about GMOs, because whatever I say, you can be sure at least half the people are going to hate my guts. So it's what Whole Foods' position on GM is very simple. We think it ought to be transparent, and people have a right to know what's in their foods. And we supported Proposition 37 here. We supported it in our stores. We did advertisements behind it. We're working internally at Whole Foods, and we're going to move towards transparency at Whole Foods on all of our foods. We do think people have a right to know, and it's complicated. We've done it on our private label. We're going to extend that to other. Regarding your issue, it's a very difficult issue. As a guy who's, again, been sensitized about if you make a remark about health care or climate change, it's headlines, I'm not going to make any comments about GMOs. I'm sorry, other than we'd like the customer has a right to know what's in their food. But you raised a very interesting issue, and if you and I were talking one-on-one and you could assure me you weren't for the media, we could have an interesting discussion about it.
Okay. Well, that would be only if he bought the book, right?
No, buying the book will not get you my position on GMOs.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
Hi. My name is Prasanna Krishnan, and I'm an aspiring social entrepreneur in the solar energy field. And in the conscious capitalism ethos, there's the talk of how to measure something beyond just finances and financial bottom line. Are you able to talk about a scenario when you had to consider how a particular decision would have more than just a financial impact, social or human, and what metric you use to evaluate that decision?
I don't understand the question. Can you?
How do you, when you have essentially a number of stakeholders? Mm-hmm. And you're trying to meet different agendas, How do you measure the impact other than the profit measurement, which is clear?
That's a good question. That's a great question. I think what you have to do is with every stakeholder group, when you're making a major strategic decision, if you're a conscious business and you're thinking about creating value for your stakeholders, you have to ask that question, does this harm any of our stakeholders? Is someone losing here? Is this benefiting all of our stakeholders? And if the answer is this is harming a stakeholder, then it's not a right strategy. You've got to think it through, and you've got to come up with a more creative solution so that all the major stakeholders can win. That's not easy. But once you begin to think this way, the creative mind now has permission to come up with solutions that you may not have been able to come up with if you didn't give it permission to go in that direction. So, you know, I've been doing it for so long that I can do it really rapidly. I can just see it. I talk about in the book about having a systems mind. In the systems mind, you can see the whole system, and you can see if we do this, it's going to be good for our customers, but it's not going to be good for our team members. We got to come up with a better solution. Or this is good for all the stakeholders, but it's really bad for the environment. Is there a better way we could do this? So you're always looking for the strategies where there's no losers. Everybody wins. No trade-offs. Only successes for everybody. That's what a conscious business does. It's not easy, but we're living in a complicated, complex world, and those are the kind of solutions that we need to come up with today.
Great. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Brian Burt. John, what are your views on the policies that will support these sort of vibrant, conscious businesses in the areas of the economy where it's a little tougher, where there's less kind of brand impact, there might be more pollution involved, tax policies, these sorts of things? What are the policies that would support more conscious capitalist businesses?
Well, other than what you just talked about with the environment, I don't think you need any government policies. If anything, it's harder to be an entrepreneur today than when I got started. There's just a lot more regulations. The funny thing about regulations is that we add new ones on every year, but the old ones never go away. We just layer new ones on top of it, on top of it, on top of it, where it becomes more difficult for a young business. I mean, we documented in the book, for example, that and this is from the Small Business Administration, has documented that we spend about $1.75 trillion a year, business does. Fulfilling regulation requirements. That's more than our government collects in income taxes. So the regulatory burden on business is huge. And of course, I'm not saying we shouldn't have any regulations. It's funny, I find that if you ever question the need for regulations, it's like, Mackey's opposed to all regulations. Well, you know, I'm not. I mean, we need regulations in our society. I'm not talking about anarchism. But we also need to develop some type of systems where the old bad regulations, which aren't working, can get rid of them. And they just stay there, and they continue to be burdensome for business, and it becomes more and more difficult to do business. Environment is clearly an area where we need government regulations. And because there's a tragedy of the commons, you're going to have externalities are going to be produced, and you don't want the good guys to be punished and the bad guys to reap a windfall from it. So to me, that's a clear area where we need good government regulations. And but in almost any other area, I'm not sure that we need, you know, government to support it. We just need some ways government to get out of the way or back off so business can do its entrepreneurial thing.
I'd add pharmaceutical, probably.
What?
Pharmacy as another industry where you need regulation.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a great example of what I would call crony capitalism now, because it costs $1 billion to bring a drug to market.
Right.
No startup, no entrepreneurial company can even play. So now you just have these mega-large pharmaceutical businesses, and they have the whole market to themselves. There's nobody's allowed to innovate. No one's allowed to compete. And that makes it, that definitely cuts back on innovations and creativity because we just don't have that entrepreneurial market. Of course, we need some type of regulation on it, but the way it's been rigged, this is a great example of the pharmaceutical industry is a great industry example of what you call regulatory capture, where the people that are regulating it end up working for the pharmaceutical industry, and the people in the pharmaceutical industry end up being the regulators. And so that type of regulations and still bad things happen,
so
right?
Would it be right to say then that, John, it's not so much regulation, I mean, as much as an impediment to monopolistic behavior that you...
It's the old problem of who guards the guardians, right. Who regulates the regulators. We all know we need regulations, But people make this mistake in believing that, you know, business needs to be regulated, but somehow or another, there's never failure at government level. That the that there's market failure, but there's never government failure. To me, we have market failure and we have government failure. And we don't have good ways to always to correct government failure.
Okay, last question, sir.
Do you think that the recent farm bill that Congress passed is compatible with the philosophy expressed in conscious capitalism and with Whole Foods? And if you don't, how would you change farm policy in the United States to make it more compatible with your beliefs?
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with conscious capitalism, because you're really asking a political question. And I've already stated that conscious capitalism has nothing to do with politics. It's about a way of managing business that allows businesses to be managed differently and more consciously, and higher purpose, stakeholders, the things I talked about. If you're asking me about the Farm Bill, of course, I haven't read it, so I can't really address it in a lot of ways. The only thing I would say about it is that I don't like the way the Farm Bill subsidizes all these things. Another example of crony capitalism. We have this Farm Bill, and it subsidizes the corn growers here, and I've often thought one of the worst things we're doing in America that talks about, somebody asked me the question about alleviating poverty. One of the ways America contributes to world poverty is we, through subsidies and through tariffs, we keep the poor people around this world from selling to our country. It's a great wrong. And would be the American consumers would benefit because they would get less expensive produce from around the world, and those farmers would benefit because they'd have the great market of America to sell into. So that'd be a win-win for the consumers and for them. What prevents it is you've got an agricultural system that is protecting American farmers, and oftentimes with tariffs from stuff coming in from abroad, but even worse with subsidies in some of the areas that least need subsidies, like corn production. I mean, probably half the people here probably read Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma. He was wrong about Whole Foods in that book, let me tell you right now. But he was right about the farm, the corn, the section on corn there. And it was he did a great service to people to begin to wake people up about these type of agricultural subsidies in the area like corn production. So I would, if you ask me, if you left it up to me, I'd just eliminate all subsidies. I don't think the government should be taking taxpayer money and giving it to farmers, basically.
So, John, this is an Inform program, and every Inform program ends by asking the speaker to address the same question. It's hard because your whole book is addressing this one question, but you have to put it into a 60-second answer. So what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Business is good, and it can be a lot better. And our culture is becoming more conscious. It's essential that business become more conscious. And business has a very bad reputation, and it's partly because it's portrayed as greedy and selfish. And so business needs to discover its higher purpose. It needs to begin to deliver value consciously for all of its stakeholders and not just its investors. It needs a leadership that serves the business and serves the stakeholders. And it needs to create cultures where human beings can reach their full potential. They can be empowered, they can flourish, and they can self-actualize themselves. That's the message in our book. I hope you read the book, and I hope you like it.
Well, we want to thank you very much, John McKay, for giving us such a great program and your feelings on conscious capitalism and sharing your ideas and insights with us, not to mention giving a sneak peek on where Whole Foods is going, which is quite exciting. Now, this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.